Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, the 11th of October. I hope you're doing well. I am recovering from a car break-in, which resulted in the loss of my beloved laptop. So I don't know why I'm laughing about that, but I'm using an old system here, and I'm hoping I'm coming through okay. I've already tested this, so we should be good. I'll tell you, it's a little unnerving when you have your car broken into. Of course, it's something that happens every single day, and I live in a big city. I live in Oakland, and Oakland has its problems. And actually, the event occurred in the city next door to me, a city called Emeryville. I don't know if you're familiar with Northern California. Anyhow, make a long story short, I'm sorry that I lost that. That was a good computer. So anyhow, lots to talk about today. I hope you're doing well. Our guest today is Steve Mayers, who wrote a book called Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. We'll talk with him in a second. But I have been posting references to a number of people. Earlier this year, Dr. Klaus Schmidt, who was the research and excavation director at Göbekli Tepe, passed away suddenly, and he left quite a body of work. A lot of people ask me about Göbekli Tepe. Right now it's been dated at about 12,000 BC, excuse me, making it one of the most sophisticated ancient ruins that we've discovered, much older than the Great Pyramid and the Giza Plateau. But a lot of people don't know exactly what he discovered and the importance of it. And yesterday I posted a TEDx Prague talk, TED talk, specific to a city, where Dr. Schmidt actually gives an overview of the discovery and its importance. It's very short. I think it's only like about 20 minutes. And I really suggest those of you who are not familiar with Göbekli Tepe and its importance in historical references to give it a shot, give it a quick look, and hear what he has to say. I don't know if there has been somebody who has been appointed his successor, but it was a great loss. We heard from Andrew Collins, who was out there recently, and we heard from a number of people. Anthony West, Robert Schock, who have met with Schmidt and found him to be very open-minded when it comes to dating and the possibilities, ramifications of Göbekli Tepe in the world view of ancient history. So anyhow, it's a good starting point. It's a good primer is what I call it for Göbekli Tepe. So have a look. It's on, by the way, as always, Earth Ancients is the radio is part of the Earth Ancients Facebook page, and you just got to go into Facebook if you're new. You got to register and everything like that, and then punch in Earth Ancients, I have a blog, a community blog, but the page that has the bulk of my research, my information, is the fan page, which is just Earth Ancients. So make sure that you go to that fan page to discover everything I'm talking about. Some other areas that I want to point out, Peter DeJong, who's an associate of mine, has worked and studied ancient cultures in Peru and in South America. And he has a number of interesting short videos on vitrified stone, stone that's been heated to a great degree and then somehow carved. And I just posted a very interesting short video where Jesus Gamarra, the son of the great Alberto Gamarra, Alfredo Gamarra, is talking about some very interesting stonework that Chincherio, Cusco, Peru. And it's a very unique video. It's because it really shows in depth the machine work, machining of this entrance way, this door entrance way. And Jan's been criticized over the years for his claims of vitrification. And I tend to think he's right. Of course, I'm not a scientist or a chemist, but there is a technology involved, a science involved in how this, these rocks were cut, how these stones were excised and carved that we just don't understand. And he's done some chemical analysis, and he, as far as he can say, he believes it is some kind of a tool that was used high heat and actually cut into the stone and left evidence. So Details of the Door Found in Chincherio, Cusco, Peru is the title. It's a short video with Jesus Gamarra, and it's really good. It's another good primer for what's happening, what is the details, what is the remains of the stone after the tool was used. So These are questions that no scientist can answer because of the technology that doesn't exist anymore. Could be even a physics that we don't know about either in the application of the tool to stone. The stone becomes molten almost and becomes very, very soft. So check that out on the Facebook page. Just go through the page. There's a couple of things here. Ancient Egyptians in Australia, the final verdict molded into stone is a Steve and Evan Strong article that came out a few months ago, and I've reposted it here. It's very unique. There's a lot of evidence that a branch of the dynastic Egyptians were actually sea travelers, and they traveled all the way down to Australia. And they have some pretty good physical evidence that is something you want to check out. So that's on the Facebook page too. So we're going to be speaking with Steve Mayers here, Lost Technology of the Great Pyramid. Steve wrote two books. We're going to focus on both of them, but the body of this this presentation, which was recorded earlier this week, is The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. So I'm going to play it now, and I hope you enjoy it, and I will get back to you at the end after we're completed. So here's the interview with Steve Mayers.
So today my guest is Steve Mayers. He's the author of two books. His first book, the focus of the title of the program, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid. And his second book, which I guess just recently came out, is The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. And he's a author, lecturer, independent research. He's studied the Great Pyramid for over 20 years to understand how this ancient wonder was built. More importantly, why it was built. And according to this bio, he worked extensively on the Giza Plateau. Steve's written a number of articles and has compiled the research based on that time on the Giza Pyramid for the creation of two books. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Great. So tell the audience a little bit about the background behind your interest in the Great Pyramid and what brought you out there to study that.
Well, I've always kind of been interested in technology and also history. I like antique gasoline engines. I collect those. And when I studied World War II in high school, I was more interested in the range of a plane and a bomb load and how the battleships operated, that type of stuff, more than who the generals were. So I've always enjoyed technology and history. And if you like those two subjects, your focus will ultimately land on the Great Pyramid because it's a 45-story skyscraper that exhibits some interesting high technology, but was built in ancient history.
Okay, so you spent quite a bit of time over there. So you must have gone over there and just been awestruck when you first walked up to that massive stone edifice, or whatever they want to call it.
Yes, it is awe-inspiring. It's virtually incomprehensible to see something that huge, that is so mysterious, so misunderstood even in the 21st century, and just to see it, just to stand in its shadow and look up at it, and also to comprehend the size of the components. The stones are extremely large, so it is, if anyone can, Even in this day and age, get a chance to get over to Egypt, do it, because it's there's no other place like it in the world.
Well, let me ask you. You just said something interesting, and obviously you've studied it. You've probably read all the books from Tompkins to whoever else. I mean, there's hundreds of books that are written about the Great Pyramid. But why do you think it's, why do you say it's misunderstood? Why would you say something like that?
Well, I think that it's misunderstood for a lot of reasons. One justification to make that statement is that there are so many answers to the question of how it was built. Just like if there were so many answers to the question of what is 2 + 2, and you could have a whole bunch of answers, then probably something is misunderstood. And all of these answers to why the Great Pyramid was built or how it was built are mutually exclusive, but mainly they are not demonstrable. It's an answer that they say ancient people did, but then modern people seemingly can't recreate what ancient people did.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's misunderstood.
Okay, and do you believe there's a science, an unknown science involved here, or is it, in your mind, constructed with known physics and science that we understand?
Probably both. Certainly there's things that we understand that came into play when the Great Pyramid was built, like gravity, the weight of the stones, and other things. But there could have been things that we don't know that were utilized, different energies, different capabilities, that modern mankind is unaware of. That's a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The basis of the book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, your hypothesis is that these massive multi-ton blocks of granite were floated in different stages to create the actual pyramid structure itself. Can you tell us how and what was the evidence and how that may have been applied? What was the evidence that helped you make that conclusion that they used a water-based system to float these massive blocks into place?
Oh, certainly. That's the gist of the book, is that the stones on barges were moved through water locks and then ultimately moved to their final location. But the evidence, there's a tremendous amount of evidence. Herodotus, the 5th century BC historian, described the Great Pyramid as being like an island surrounded by water. And up until the 18th century, there was a wall around the Great Pyramid. That was evidence. And we think that the purpose of that wall was to impound water, which was part of the construction process. Also, there was what Flanders Petrie discovered inside the Great Pyramid in the passages and chambers was Nile earth, which is sediment. So there was sediment, which was probably brought in by water, inside the Great Pyramid. And you wouldn't think that there would be sediment in a tomb, but with the construction process using water, then there would probably be sediment. Also, the casing stones are the stones that are on the outside of the Great Pyramid, and they are bonded together watertight. They are cut with extreme precision. In fact, the most precise of all the stones are the casing stones, and cemented together watertight. That's not to keep all that Egyptian rain out of the Great Pyramid, but we think that that impounded water. And there's a whole host of other types of evidence that indicates water was on the Giza Plateau. That includes water erosion even on the Sphinx, which is downhill from the Great Pyramid, and just a lot of types of evidence. Even some of the casing stones, especially on the backside, if you will, had what appears to be water erosion on those. So lots of evidence.
Some of the interior stones, especially in the King's Chamber, weigh in excess of 50 to 70 tons each. How would they float a monolith into position and put that together? That's fascinating. What is your thinking on something like that? Because I mean, I've seen pictures. I haven't been there, but I've seen pictures of this, of the King's Chamber, and those are just monstrous stones.
Yes, they are. Actually, those stones, everyone agrees that those stones were moved on barges from the quarries, which were about 400 miles upstream, or south, if you will, from the Giza Plateau. Everyone agrees with that. And they were floated on barges down to the, at least near the Great Pyramid. But we think that there were some water locks that went from the Nile River all the way up to the building site. And those 70-ton stones were moved with ease. The Erie Canal, which was built in the 1830s, had a capacity, the barges had a capacity of, believe it or not, 70 tons, and the Erie Canal was 4.5 feet deep. So in the 1830s, people could move 70-ton payloads. When they built the Great Pyramid, people could move 70-ton payloads. Egyptologists who say they know how it was done, the entire science has never moved a 70-ton payload 1 inch.
So what is the evidence that you found that barges were used? Because in your book, you use some fascinating graphics where you show the base, the pyramid base, and then I guess they filled that with water, and then as they began stacking the stones, they would, what did they do? You theorize that they pumped the water out and then repumped it in for the next level? Or tell us a little bit about what your hypothesis is for the actual building of that pyramid, the Great Pyramid.
Okay, great. Our contention is that water was made available at the Giza Plateau by the original builders. And the first stones that were set in place was the bottom layer of casing stones, which were cut very precise and cemented together. So those stones, when set in place, created a square wall. And some of those stones still exist today in their original location.
Those are porcelain.
That square wall.
Yeah, go ahead.
That square wall was filled with water, so there was a pond. And there were water locks from the Nile River all the way up to the building site that actually went into that pond. So they would fill that pond with stones from barges, the interior stones, right into the pond. They would take them off the barge and set them into the pond. And when that pond was filled, the first layer of the Great Pyramid was completed. And they built the Great Pyramid layer by layer. Our website has a video series that, with a lot of computer-generated animations, that has all the details of this fascinating construction process. And that's at thepump.org for that video series.
Okay. And as the levels of stonework rose 50, 100 feet, how did they get the water up in that higher area? Because that's a lot of pressure that has to be created to get the water up high there.
That's correct. It's a lot of pressure. And also a lot of huge volume of water. In fact, the weight of the water used to build the Great Pyramid was greater than the weight of the Great Pyramid. But anyway, our contention, before the Great Pyramid was built, the subterranean passages and chambers were constructed below the building site. And those acted sort of like a hydraulic ram water pump. And that water pump supplied water for this pond for each level and for the water locks. It gives a functional purpose for those cuttings instead of what Egyptologists say was that, oh, they cut down 100 feet below the Great Pyramid and started to make this passage, and then they changed their minds. But our contention is that it all has a functional purpose, and that purpose was to pump water.
So what references did you discover of other buildings that may have had the similar type of engineering behind it? Because it's fascinating to read what you describe as an engineering building construction technique that is uses water and barges and levees. Is there any other examples of that? Because a number of people have talked about the great channels and underground waterways that exist on the Giza Plateau, because at one time the water was much closer to that plateau area. But what is your theory behind the reference points of that? Are there references of other buildings like this?
Certainly on the Giza Plateau, there are a lot of passages and tunnels. Also, the Nile River was in a different location in very distant antiquity, and it has moved and changed course through the eons of time. But our focus is on how the Great Pyramid was built, not how other pyramids were built or other structures around the world. What we're doing is trying to understand how a specific building was constructed and what its original purpose was that the builders intended for it.
Okay.
So our focus is the Great Pyramid.
Okay. So let's talk about the makeup of the Great Pyramid. The King's Chamber, the Queen's Chamber, the Subterranean Chamber, why was this chamber, a subterranean chamber, built, and these massive walkways or corridors cut into the or built into the system too? Was there a reason for that?
Yeah, the corridors are at about 26 degrees, which is pretty steep, and they don't have steps. And also, you have to bend over about double if you want to try and walk through them, almost have to crawl. So it's real uncomfortable for walking. But we think that the intent of those passages was as, in effect, pipes to transport water. And we contend water came down the descending passage to the subterranean chamber, and the upper part of that chamber had air that was compressed to a very high degree. This subterranean pump had a head of 100 feet, so it had quite a bit of force to compress the air, and ultimately through some valves that aren't there anymore because they've been destroyed, it was able to pump water up in through the Greaves chamber. It's a small chamber in the bedrock, and ultimately up into the mound of bedrock that the Great Pyramid was built on. And that was the purpose for those subterranean cuttings, and it made possible the movement of stones so that the Great Pyramid could be built.
Okay. Well, let's get down to it now. And let me ask you this. What is your contention? What is your theory on who built the Great Pyramid? Do you believe that it's Khufu, or are you feeling that's more pre-dynastic with a technology that was lost to the dynastic Egyptians?
Actually, who built the Great Pyramid is beyond the focus of our research. A person can get caught up in that and debate it for their entire life and never get anywhere. So, you know, who built it is not our focus. When it was built is not our focus either. You know, we're not focused on the date of construction or when it was completed. Certainly we're interested in how it operated as a water pump and how it was assembled. But you can look at what Egyptologists say is the nature of ancient Egypt, that civilization. And they, Egyptologists, understand that civilization, or they say they do, but they can't show that that civilization could have made even the components of the Great Pyramid. A casing stone, some of them weighed 16 tons and were cut with extreme precision. The science of Egyptology says they know how it was done. It was done with hand tools and bronze chisels. But the entire science of Egyptology worldwide since the inception of Egyptology has never made a single casing stone. And they have never made a single surface of one casing stone. So, so you know, you take what they say with a grain of salt at the very least. For some they don't engage in the scientific method. They know how it was done, but they can't demonstrate it. That's very telling evidence for their assessment of the direct physical evidence of the Great Pyramid.
So in your thinking, in your evaluation, their conclusion that hand chisels and copper equipment was completely inadequate to cut stone and build the pyramid.
I think that every book that Egyptologists have written that say that are wrong. I think that they cannot demonstrate that's how it was done. Plus, I think that it is impossible to do that. Yet they still stay with that story and just keep telling it. It's a tenet of a belief system.
Exactly. Well, let me ask you this. Have you read the works of the engineer Christopher Dunn? and how he believes they cut the stone.
Yes. He wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant, and he also wrote another book, but that's the one you're referring to.
Yeah.
And he talked about the precision of the stone cutting and also that it can't be done by hand. And he is, you know, it's a marvelous book. I recommend everyone to read it and, you know, come to their own conclusions. But he also considers the Great Pyramid to be a machine, a functioning machine that served a purpose, that the Great Pyramid was infrastructure for the civilization that built it. The Great Pyramid was not built at a high cost, but the Great Pyramid was built as a wise investment. It turned, you know, it turned work into leisure. It turned poverty into prosperity. It changed the desert. It transformed it into a garden. That's what I think. And that it was a prosperity machine that did all of that by pumping water.
Okay. So let's move now to your hypothesis of what the actual pyramidal structure was built for. And in your book, you say that it was designed as a pump. So tell us about your theory and how that works, how it became a pump, as you call it, a pump for prosperity.
Well, the Great Pyramid subterranean chambers served as a water pump, but also the passages and chambers served as a water pump as well. And those two pumps are connected together in series. It kind of supercharged it, if you will. And water entered the descending passage, went through the lower pump that we talked about a little bit, and then came up into the lower end of the grand gallery. And it, our contention is that the electrolysis process occurred in that chamber, which separated the hydrogen and oxygen, and that those gases were ignited in that chamber, which ultimately, believe it or not, created a vacuum. And that vacuum drew water up into the grand gallery higher. And that vacuum, through some linkages and valves, that vacuum was opened. And then that water column, that huge water column, probably 300 tons of water, moved back down the grand gallery and into the queen's chamber. Then it ultimately went into the king's chamber, and then out the king's chamber vents were the discharge of the pump. And then from those vents, we believe that the casing stones, which are now gone, held an additional passage that the water was transported to the where the water was used in a whole host of purposes, including irrigation, run heavy machinery, possibly to create compressed air for industrial purposes, and other reasons.
So you believe that this pump probably was able to create, you know, it's a huge structure. It was able to create very high pressure to a degree where they could actually run machinery.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
The largest structure in North America is the Grand Coulee Dam, and most expensive when built. It's in central Washington, and it makes a lot of electricity, but its primary purpose is to pump water. It's a self-contained, self-powered water pump on the Columbia River. Anyway, in modern times, mankind has built a huge water pump. And in ancient times, I contend that the original builders designed and built a huge water pump.
Okay. So, in your second book, The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine, tell us what that means. How does the pump create prosperity? Is it because it is able to irrigate tremendous areas of land for crops or what? What is the prosperity? How does that work?
Well, okay. Prosperity, both of us live in the United States, and one of the reasons why we have prosperity is because we have a fairly strong infrastructure. We have roads. We have electricity that is available 24 hours a day. We have bridges and waterways that are well-maintained and reliable transportation. We have, you know, hospital systems and pharmacies and everything you need for prosperity. And all of that is because of infrastructure. And our contention is the Great Pyramid was kind of like a hydroelectric dam. It operated differently, but it was a big infrastructure project for the civilization that built it. It had nothing to do with star alignments. It had nothing to do with a dead body for a graveyard. You know, it was nothing to do with being dead. It was a machine that functioned, that operated, that if you were near it, you could feel the vibrations of it, literally. And it provided prosperity, regular irrigation, the powering of large-scale machinery, the making of compressed air, which you can do a whole host of scientific procedures with compressed air, and generation of electricity. So that's what the Great Pyramid did. We think that it was a very efficient and operational water pump, and we have a nonprofit foundation that we've established to redevelop this ancient but very high technology to help our modern but troubled world.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about that. So have you been able to reproduce the pyramid pump, as you call it, and show it actually functioning in some smaller scale?
We have built numerous components and sub-assemblies, and that is the primary purpose of our nonprofit foundation, is to actually understand the Great Pyramid, redevelop it. We actually have some investors because we're developing a product, if you will, and much of the information is proprietary, so we are not, at this point in time, making a presentation of our research. But the entire operation of the Great Pyramid water pump is detailed in my second book, and people can, if they get a chance, read that and see how the Great Pyramid prosperity machine operated, and then they can, in cottage industries or as individuals, do their own research and development for this this type of technology. All it is passages and chambers that you could use PVC pipe and polypropylene chambers and, you know, develop your own take on this technology.
So it does sound like you've experimented with a version of the pyramid and created some practical results.
Yes.
Have you?
It's very unusual type of research, and it is quite controversial. We've, like I say, have some interested parties and some funding, but and some volunteers, that type of stuff, pro bono legal counsel. Board of directors, advisors. Funding has been a struggle with this type of research, but the potential is very high. Once it gets developed, it will be an alternative to get us off of our addiction for oil, and it will be an alternative for even nuclear power plants and even hydroelectric dams, which have adverse environmental impacts. So we're trying to develop an alternative technology for the world we live in.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful that you are taking an ancient structure, studying it, and finding that it was an actual functioning, high-functioning machine, trying to replicate it today. I want to ask you three questions regarding the pyramid from your book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, and then I want to start talking a little bit about your second book, the most recent, The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. The first thing I want to ask you is, how would they deliver compressed air, and from what part of the pyramid was compressed air, where was it excreted from that pyramid?
Okay. The subterranean chamber is 100 feet below the surface of the bedrock, and the passages, the descending passage that enters that rather low in the chamber, and the upper half of that has air in it, similar to a hydraulic ram water pump. And when all the pressure from the water in the descending passage goes into the subterranean chamber, it compresses the air in that chamber. And then through some valves that operate automatically, check valves, similar to a hydraulic ram water pump, ultimately water is pumped up into the lower end of the Grand Gallery.
Okay. So they must have attached hoses or something to capture this compressed air and then used it to run machines or something? What is your feeling on that?
No, that compressed air was used internally in the subterranean chamber in that water pump to pump water. It stayed in that chamber, but just the compressed air, similar to a fire extinguisher, which has compressed air in it, pushed water up towards the lower end of the Grand Gallery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it would make sense that they would use very dense rock like granite and cut it with a high level of precision to make sure that no air would escape. So there's no way air would escape in the Grand Gallery, correct?
The Grand Gallery, if it wasn't already in a wonder of the world, it would be a wonder of the world. That's where the guides will show you, they'll take a needle and they can't put it between the two stones in the Grand Gallery. It's air and water tight and cemented together with a very strong bonding agent. So that wasn't to symbolically keep the pharaoh's soul from leaking out, but that served a functional, practical purpose, and that was the Grand Gallery was like a huge, if you will, cylinder, and water inside of it was like a huge water piston. So the features of the Great Pyramid and the construction method seemed to complement one another for the Great Pyramid being a water pump. And the interest in this research has been very high. It's very, very satisfying about that.
Okay. Okay, and so tell us how and where would the electricity be generated? Was that part of the pyramid, the interior of the pyramid that is now missing? Or is there some application of the water, compressed air, and other chemical reaction within the pyramid that caused electricity?
The output of the pump, the water, was used, I think, among other things, to generate electricity. And there are a number of very odd excavations around the Great Pyramid, everything from boat pits, one of which still has a boat in it, those very large sun barges, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also some very strange, very large, square, like 30 feet to a side that go quite deep. We think that those housed some additional machinery that the Great Pyramid powered. also possibly an air compressor, specifically a hydraulic air compressor that used the movement of water. It doesn't have a crankshaft or an impeller, but it used the movement of water to directly compress air, and some other things that the book talks about. So so that's where we think that the electricity was generated, was outside of the Great Pyramid.
Okay, and within the pyramid itself, is your feeling that there's portions that have been removed or have decayed or that were once part of the operating mechanism of the pyramid?
Oh, absolutely. Everyone agrees that the Great Pyramid is certainly not in the condition it was when it was first built. There are, in the antechamber between the Grand Gallery and the King's Chamber, there are places where there used to be stones that slid up and down, and those stones are gone, all except for one. And the casing stones on the outside have all but 1% have been removed, and the number of other things inside the Great Pyramid have been damaged. So there's a lot of things that are different about the Great Pyramid that are gone. What, you know, how do sliding stones keep a pharaoh's treasure protected? I ask Egyptologists that all the time. Oh, we don't know. How do long open passages protect the pharaoh's treasure? Oh, we don't know. But it does. Really? You know, it's strange. Strange.
It doesn't sound like you appreciate their logic.
Well, they have a story to tell. Egyptologists do, but they don't engage in the scientific method. You know, they just repeat what they learned by the last generation of Egyptologists. They the science is actually not really advancing. You know, it's just stagnating, if you will. It's a science that's in crisis. There was another science that was in crisis the first part of the 20th century, and that was phrenology. They had a story to tell. They said that the bumps on a person's head coincided with their psychological traits and all of that. And we've all seen the heads that have all these lines on it that have like different zones and emotions and stuff. That's phrenology. It was taught in universities. But something happened to that science, which is the stories it told could not be supported by the scientific method. So it ultimately went away and is now in the dustbin of discarded ideas. Egyptology is in a similar crisis. You know, they tell these stories. Oh, yeah, extremely precise precision of stone cutting was accomplished using hand tools. There's no Egyptologist, and in fact, there's no master stonemason in the world that can make a casing stone in the manner that Egyptologists say it was done. They're a hindrance to understanding truth, Egyptology is. So it's a battle to overcome the misconceptions that they've come up with. You know.
So Well, I think there are Robert Schock. Well, Robert Schock and John Anthony West and Graham Hancock all have written, you know, tremendous amount of information, as well as my guest last week, Robert Bavall.
Yes.
And he actually went head to head with Zahi Hawass, who was the Grand Supreme Director of that whole Giza Plateau. And of course, now he's been removed for hanky-panky, of course. But I think the public, as a rule, begins to question the theories of the Egyptologist. And at some point, the logic engineers. Actually, the big changes have been people like Chris Dunn and other engineers who have come and said, "Well, this is a machine. This was cut with a precision machine, so on and so forth." So that begins.
You are correct.
That punches holes in the whole idea of hand chisels and archaic craftsmanship. It's a precision machine, and that's why in the very beginning of our conversation, I asked you what your feelings were on who may have built that, and you told me that that's not really your concern, but I think it has to be your concern because in understanding how this machine works, you have to give notice to the engineers and the architects and whoever else built that this is a level of genius that we can only just stare at.
I acknowledge that the original builders were geniuses, but the Great Pyramid may have been built pre-flood, if you will, or before the Ice Age, however you want to put it. So it may not be knowable what culture built the Great Pyramid, you know, who the name of the leaders, that type of thing, or the designers. That may not be known, but their genius their understanding. I think that modern mankind has the challenge to understand what they understood, and some of the technologies that are lost certainly are methods of stone cutting that the Great Pyramid exhibits. Also, I believe that the bonding agent was very strong. They say stronger than the stones itself after at least 5,000 years. So that was a lost technology. And another thing that was lost, not the technology, but the understanding that the Great Pyramid was built with, is the use of water locks. In fact, water locks, a lot of people say, are very primitive, but they're the system of choice in the 21st century to move our heaviest objects, which are big ships. The Panama Canal is adding on another set of water locks large enough to handle aircraft carriers and also oil tankers. So in modern times, if we want to move big, heavy objects, we use water locks. I contend that in ancient times, the original builders also used water locks to move their heaviest objects.
Interesting. Let me ask you a quick question, then I want to go on to your next book. You said you reference bonding agents to adhere the stones together. Do you have evidence of this bonding agent? Is there do you have examples of it that have been tested and analyzed?
Well, there's a lot of controversy about that. The bonding agent itself, the existence that something was put between the stones, is not disputed by anyone. There are places where it has oozed out, if you will. I believe that there's some examples at the Petrie Museum in London, England. But everyone acknowledges that there was a bonding agent between the casing stones, and they acknowledge that it was tenacious, as some of the earlier writings use that word, meaning that it was very strong. So, but its composition is under debate. Egyptologists say, oh, it's plaster, and you use wet plaster to... You lay it down, and then you put another stone on it, and then it slides. Well, it's not plaster, because if you make plaster wet again, it becomes, it dissolves, if you will. And this doesn't dissolve. So
there are examples of this. There's examples of this bonding agent in the Petrie Museum. Now, this is something I haven't heard of. My whole understanding was that the precision cuts of these outer casing and the actual building stones that weigh several tons each were cut so precisely that they were just stacked on top of each other. And now you're telling me that you and other and Petrie Museum has bonding or examples of the actual polymers or
yes.
glue.
Yeah, polymer or whatever it was. Yes. Mm-hmm. In fact, just word search it on the internet. Great Pyramid and bonding agent.
I will.
Some people think that the stones were made out of cement. They were poured stones
yes.
instead of, and there's you know, lots of pros and cons about that as well. But yeah, there was bonding agent between the casing stones. There had to have been to make it watertight and also to withstand the tremendous amount of was involved.
Well, according to your theory, you're right. They would have had to apply it to each stone to make it watertight. So there should be a significant amount of it behind each of those facing stones as well as the stone's interior, right?
Well, they wouldn't be behind it. They would be between them, if you will,
uh-huh.
to bond the two stones together,
right.
both on their vertical sides that connected and as well as on the tops. So that would be the bottom of the next higher one. So, yeah. Yeah, that's consistent with the direct physical evidence.
Right. Fantastic. Let's talk about your newest book, The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine. Now, tell us, you've talked a little bit about the prosperity aspect of this Great Pyramid as the tool for growing agriculture, tool for generating electricity, and then also a machine for, as you call it, delivering compressed air to run machines. So,
mm-hmm.
so is that the theory behind the prosperity the pyramid?
Oh yes,
the machine.
Yeah, that's
okay.
The theory behind it. That it was it that the Great Pyramid. Served a purpose, and that purpose wasn't religious at all. That purpose wasn't societal, if you will. It wasn't a way to pay a tax, but that the Great Pyramid was an investment, and that investment paid off a thousandfold. Just like the Hoover Dam, you know, the amount of electricity runs industry, it runs agriculture, and everything else. I mean, it's infrastructure for the civilization that built it, and it improved their lives and the lives of their children. Actually, prosperity in worldwide, the definition of prosperity is if you got a full belly and you know you're going to have a full belly tomorrow, then by golly, you're doing good. You know, and you
yeah.
know that's prosperity. You know, but
yeah.
You know, us Americans take that for granted. But
yeah.
the ancient builders in the Nile Valley, they knew what prosperity was, and they built themselves a great big machine to deliver prosperity.
Okay. So tell me about this book on prosperity. So I'm basically giving away, I guess, what the most fundamental aspect of the book is that this machine produced various helped with various industries, right?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes.
What else? Was the benefit, and what else can you tell us that you discovered about this giant machine from book two?
Well, my first book just talks about how the Great Pyramid was assembled, which is a fascinating story in and of itself. No big ramp or anything. But my second
mm-hmm.
book talks about why it was built, and it also talks about in detail. It's kind of a technical book, but not too bad. There's not a lot of math, but it talks about how the Great Pyramid operated as a functioning machine, and that machine pumped water. You know, what the Queen's Chamber was for, what the King's Chamber was for, and the passages,
mm-hmm.
you know, between them. You know, how they worked, and there's and it goes into quite a bit of detail between the Grand Gallery and the Queen's Chamber. There's a step, and what that step is for, you know, and then a lot of other features about the Great Pyramid, which makes it a machine. You know, You know, if you lift the hood of your car, it's a pretty complicated machine, but all it does, all of that stuff under the hood of the car is just makes the car move, if you will. And the Great Pyramid is kind of complicated, more complicated than a tomb for a dead guy. You know, it's got all these passages, chambers, it's built with extreme precision.
Hello? I think we just lost him. We will try calling him back. We're just about at the end here. And okay. So my guest, Stephen Mayers, is up here in Oregon. And I'm going to try dialing him again so we can complete our interview here. There we go.
I'm back.
There you go. I don't know what happened there.
Oh, I don't know. I think the Egyptologist got after us. But what I was saying.
Say the, yeah, go
all,
ahead.
All of these features ultimately focus on the Great Pyramid actually doing something. You know, it wasn't a building for the dead. It was for the living. You know, the Great Pyramid itself was alive and then pumped this water. And then, of course, the last part of my second book is about how to the importance of redeveloping this ancient but very high technology for our modern times. You know, we use a lot of ancient technologies in our modern world. A lot of medicines come out of South America that the witch doctors talk about. The leaves that aspirin are from. Our doctor says, yeah, take two aspirins and call me in the morning. The witch doctor says, chew two leaves and call me in the morning. You know, it's the same thing. The ancient Egyptians, they had birth control. They had C-sections. They had a whole host of medical knowledge. South America, they did terrapanning, which is brain surgery on living people. There's lots of skulls in South America that show that they survived and the cuts were remodeled, if you will. In other words, they lived and healed to some degree. So we use a lot of ancient technologies, a lot. And I think that this very unique water pumping technology is quite efficient and will become an alternative for our oil and other very adverse, energy systems that we have. Very, very.
Well, let's talk about that because maybe that's something I haven't brought up here. Now, did you, in your research and in your nonprofit, did you find a form of technology that is extracted from the pyramid that is able to run machines on their own? Or self-contained engines that don't need petrochemicals?
Yeah, the energy that's used to power machinery is the output of the water pump. So that's that. But we're, Tesla tried to develop a energy system that didn't have a meter for people to read to pay a bill every month. But ultimately, with his Wiedenclyffe Tower over in New York, but when it was determined that there wasn't going to be a meter for everyone to pay money every month, his funding was cut off. And that system wasn't developed. And we ended up developing a system that we use where we all have to go down to the gas station and buy our gas. And then we have the ability to travel. I call that funding the terrorists. You know, that's what we're doing. We're transferring money back to the Middle East. You know, the terrorists, they got to be able to buy bombs and knives to cut off heads. So that's where they get their money from us. You know, it's terrible.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
Or we do nuclear power plants, and then that thing over there in Fukushima or whatever. Oh, my. The power plants generate electricity so we can run our electric razors and charge our phones and stuff. And then that horrific environmental disaster over there, You know, it's just unimaginable that we would do things like that to the Earth. You know, let's say that nuclear power plant made $10 million a year for 10 years, and then on the 11th year, it had the meltdown, and it cost, let's say, $50 billion to repair the damages. So, in effect, it never made money, if you take that into consideration. You know, and then we have energy systems that are centralized, like hydroelectric dams. You know, we can fund them because we can all pay our money. But, you know, it's just terrible. We need to change. There's a revolution going on. You can see it on YouTube. All of these people in their garages and back rooms trying to develop, you know, magnet motors, things with hydrogen. You know, we just have to get off of this the oil. We're in a not the age of the electron or the age of the computer. We're in the age of oil, this 1870s technology. You know, it's good because the oil traders, they get money. You know, they make more money than we can understand. But somehow we have to get off of it, and our foundation is doing our little part about understanding the genius of ancient mankind, but also trying to redevelop their ancient technology for our modern world.
Fantastic. Well, Steve, thank you for being my guest. Steve's books are available on Amazon. The first book, Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, and his newest book, The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine, are both available on Amazon and other...
Yeah, also as Kindle e-books.
Okay, right.
Both
so why don't you give us...
Kindle.
Oh, they are Kindle. Okay. So,
Kindle or soft cover.
Give us the your web links to the foundation. Now, the one that I have, which I'll post, is called The Pump. So it's www.thepump.org, thepump.org. And then, let's see here, Steve's website is 3dubs.steve.myers.org. So do you have anything else you'd like to leave us with, Steve?
One last thing. We're doing a crowdfunding effort for a 3D printer for our facility, and we're getting some donations. But if anyone is interested in being involved in helping us fund our 3D printer, they can go to our website at thepump.org, and all donations are tax deductible because we're a nonprofit foundation.
Okay, fantastic. One last thing. Steve has promised to send me some photographs to post on the Facebook page, and these are photographs that he's going to collect that kind of tell the story. But, of course, we want you to buy his book, and you can get them at those locations, Amazon or on his site. Steve, it's been a pleasure. Much more success to you, and we'll look forward to reading about your continued effort in researching and producing modern technology based on the ancient past.
Well, thank you, Cliff, very much for having me on my show and on your show, and I really appreciate this opportunity.
Hey, my pleasure. All right, thank you very much.
So that was Steve Mayers, Lost Technology in the Great Pyramid. You can tell that he has a scathing assessment of Egyptology. Steve's been to Giza numerous times, and like many of us who observe the Great Pyramid, the description given it by Egyptologists and how it was built is pretty mind-boggling. It's just such fantasy. It's ridiculous. You got, and this is the beauty of having people like Chris Dunn and
Robert Bevall describe it from an engineer's perspective, and it really becomes a fantastic piece of work, a fantastic a machine, if you will. So there's a number of people who are very question Egyptologists in their assessment of many of the ancient buildings on the Giza Plateau. It'll be interesting to see what Steve and his foundation are able to produce technology-wise. I spoke to him offline, and he's not really willing to describe what technology they're creating. The specifics of it. It's based on what they discovered at the pyramid. So. The foundation of the pump, you can go to thepump.org and read more about it. So that's it for today's show. We hope to see you next time on Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past. Also, check with us each day on Facebook, Earth Ancients on Facebook, and I am going to be posting some of my research on ancient astronauts of the ancient world, not ancient astronauts as in terms of aliens, but examples of carvings and figurines that have technology that we just don't understand. So take a look at that. I'll be posting that later on today. It's a short video that I created about 2-3 years ago. All right. Have a great day, and I will look forward to having you with us again next time. Thank you.